Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp, and it makes onboarding new employees a breeze. We love it so much, we really do use it ourselves, and we have 4 years, and I personally recommend you give it a try, no matter how small your business is. And to sweeten the deal, just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/beingboss, that's gusto.com/beingboss.
Hello, and welcome to Being Boss, a podcast for creative entrepreneurs. I'm Emily Thompson.
And I'm Kathleen Shannon.
I'm Jeremy Bailey, and I am Being Boss.
Today, we're talking about design thinking with Jeremy Bailey. As always, you can find all the tools, books, and links we reference on the show notes at www.beingboss.club.
Okay, bosses, I was shocked whenever Emily shared with me this week that she once had a coaching client who had a stack of unsent invoices for clients, and they were like months old. She was literally leaving money on the table. Now, I don't know about you bosses listening, but I've got bills to pay. And sometimes it can be hard to stay on top of billing, not to mention getting over the anxiety of asking someone for money, even if you earned it. And this is why I love FreshBooks Cloud Accounting so much. It makes billing your clients so easy, professional, and even automated. FreshBooks has so many invoicing features, including getting paid a deposit upfront, setting up recurring invoices for retainer clients, and even being able to see when a client has opened their invoice. Try FreshBooks Cloud Accounting for free by going to freshbooks.com/beingboss and enter Being Boss in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
We know Jeremy Bailey as the creative director for product at FreshBooks, where he leads a passionate team of designers striving to create a world where anyone can lead a successful small business without ever having to learn accounting. But he also moonlights as the owner of his own small business, performing as a self-proclaimed famous new media artist, playfully solving big problems with creativity and technology, often very poorly, on the internet and in cities all over the world.
Jeremy, it's so exciting to see your face and have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here, despite for your listeners, if they don't know, I'm on the train tracks right now, or there are trains going by behind me, so I apologize about that.
I love it. So you're at FreshBooks headquarters, where we had Being Boss Toronto, and we loved getting to hang with you guys there, and we had like a few speakers giving talks in between our live podcast recording, and you gave a talk all about the creative process and ideation, and we really wanted to bring you on the show to talk about that. But before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at FreshBooks?
Yeah, so I'm creative director at FreshBooks, which is kind of an intentionally ambiguous term, but I basically direct the design teams here, specifically the product design team. But that more and more, that's like also helping us just all be more creative and produce better work. So that's why I say it's ambiguous. I also work as an artist part-time, which FreshBooks has always very generously supported. My life is like, I have a persona online who calls himself he's a self-proclaimed famous new media artist. So he goes around trying to save the world rather naively with technology and solution first kind of thinking. He's kind of the antithesis, of myself as a creative director, but, he's quite hilarious in how
he
messes
hold
up.
Is this kind of like Jim Carrey's Man in the Moon kind of situation? What's that? Do you know who I'm talking about?
It's like Andy Kaufman.
Yes,
yeah, I guess
Andy
it's
Kaufman.
A little bit. I definitely love Andy Kaufman's comedy. And yes, I have sort of like he's like a comedian. It's comic in a way. I wear like jorts and a turtleneck. And so sometimes most people actually know me as that, not as creative director at FreshBooks. Most people that I run into, like when I'm speaking as a designer, will be like, wait a second, are you that guy that wears a turtleneck? And does augmented reality software performances. And I'm like, yeah, but by day, I'm also creative director. So
that is so funny. And I want to clarify for our listeners. So FreshBooks does sponsor Being Boss, and we've worked with you guys for a long time. But this is in no way an ad for FreshBooks. We just really wanted to talk to you as a creative on that team. I just want to clarify that. But okay, we need to go back to this thing, though. You're wearing a turtleneck and jorts. And, like, where are you performing at? Like, what kind of stuff? Like, what? Can you explain it a little
I mean, that's
more?
What I started out doing. That's what I went to school for. So I think as a performance artist, I guess that's the category I fit into. But I come from kind of a video art background. That's what I went to school for. And there's, like, a rich history that goes back to the 1970s of people performing with technology. People like Yoko Ono and Nam June Paik and John Cage. Like, all of these, like, it's wrapped up in there's, like, a rich cultural history there. But the best history from that time was that people started to make up their own identities or design their own identities as persona. And sort of it was the first time that they could get their faces on mainstream media. Like in the 1970s, actually, you know, it was crazy to have your face on TV, right? You would have had to be on the nightly news or a celebrity or something. So at that time, like artists started performing like on television, right? For the first time, they started recording themselves and calling it, video art. And that's my background. So when I went to grad school for video art, my thesis was like, what's changed since the 1970s? Like, how do we, you know, what devices do we perform for today? And from, you know, at that time, it was like web cameras and laptops had become, you know, the devices we perform for. And then like mobile phones and like the internet and live streaming and, so much of that is wrapped up in this, like, in the same kind of experiments that we're having in the 1970s that resulted in these, like, you know, just being famous on the internet. So, or being famous on TV, but the act of pretending to be famous. So I pretend to be famous on the internet, I guess, is the,
that's
is the bottom
okay,
line.
I feel like I'm getting it.
Like, yeah, I'm famous on the internet. It's like saying you're famous in Tokyo or famous wherever, you know. We're all sort of performing fame every day. And actually, like, I believe that that's actually, like, a really powerful thing. That's kind of something that was promised. Remember when the internet came along and they're like, now the media is in your hands.
Yeah.
And then, like, I don't know, Facebook came along and ruined it for us or whatever, but manipulated the elections. But before that.
Right.
Before that, right? Like, the media was in our hands and that was the original promise. And I still believe that that's, like, a really radical, exciting reality and gesture just to get out there like you are with your podcast or whomever and express yourself in the internet. For me as a young artist anyway, that was where the audience was, and I could see that it was moving there more and more. It was less and less, like, I started out doing film and video festivals and those were really exciting too, but less and less audiences were there, and more the people that understood kind of the crazy things I was doing were online. And now, of course, like, I can't even compete in a way. So I'm just like a marginal figure in what is otherwise like a huge sea of zany, crazy things going on the internet. But yeah, that's why I do it. Why I love doing it still.
I love this so much. I love this, like, this form of self-expression that really is driven by this, I don't know, I guess the technology to share in a lot of ways. Like, if it weren't, it sounds like if it weren't for the avenue of sharing, this wouldn't be created in quite the same way. So I love that this is creation for the purpose of sharing in ways that not a lot of people, like a lot of people who paint will paint for themselves or whatever, but this is really for the purpose of sharing it with others in whatever avenue is currently available.
And that's kind of like what the internet changed about self-expression in a way, I might say, is that it, like, it became, and in the 1970s and 60s, they had this idea of a happening. Are you familiar with this concept?
Yeah.
I don't know, like people like John Lennon and Yoko Ono that I mentioned earlier, John Cage, they had this concept that, like, art was no longer going to happen on the wall. It was going to happen in the head, on, you know, the, like, in the brain. We were going to create artworks inside people's heads. Often when I perform live, I'll like single someone out and embarrass them and say, like, we just made an artwork called Your Head is Really Warm and Embarrassed Right Now, right? But like, yeah, it was a really kind of a political or almost like radical act, because the idea that artwork couldn't be owned or belong to someone, but it belonged to us all, and that we could come together in these things called happenings, which were like just events where people got together and shared or did one thing together en masse, what we now might call, like, I don't know, user-generated content or something like that. But the it's like the link, right? we businessified it. But back then it was like, you know, it was the original poetry of that is that it's like people coming together and not to make something that they're trying to sell, but just because they want to connect. And I think that's what's always been exciting to me about art and making and design anyway is sharing, right? Listening and giving back.
Yeah, I feel like the main question that I was always asking myself in art school in college was like, what is art? And I feel like everything that you're describing here and the internet itself really helps blur the line between what is art and what isn't, right? Yeah. Everything's a creation. And that even brings me back to this idea that our podcast is for creative entrepreneurs. And everybody's creative. Like, so it's kind of a little redundant almost, yeah, to say creative entrepreneur, right, because all entrepreneurs are creative and you don't have to be an entrepreneur to be creative. So I don't know. I just think that's really cool. So with this side hustle, I just am a little curious a little bit more about it. Whenever you talked about, you know, making art and not really needing to monetize it, like, is it something that you've ever ventured down monetizing, or do you like having a day job to really fund like a side hustle or to give yourself room to breathe and be creative on the side?
Yeah. So I would say like it's been a journey to a certain extent. Like after I finished art school, of course I wanted to do it full time, but then I also didn't want to compromise conceptually on what I was doing, you know, just to sell something. And I've tried little experiments here and there, and I still have works that I do sell and then other works that I don't. But generally speaking, the reason I did it and started doing it was not for that reason. And so it always feels like when I try and fit it in that box, it's like a little bit contrived. So I used to be really ashamed that I had, like, I've always had a side hustle, and it's always been kind of easy to make money in design for me. I grew up in a design family. My dad had a design agency, and I've been kind of doing it since as long as I can remember, actually, an embarrassingly long time. And so when I finished, I was kind of ashamed, though, because in art community, anyway, you're taught, like, don't let people know you have this, like, keep the mystery and mystique and, you know, the mythology, train going by, the mythology of being an artist, keep that alive, right? Like, just keep that, because that's what the audience wants. They want that romance. Like, how does he do it? And then a few years ago, I just started being honest. Like, look, I've never made more than $10,000 a year as an artist. And the average artist internationally makes less than $10,000 a year. It's among the most precarious class of working creatives that exist on the planet. And so, you know, we all have to be a little bit more honest with ourselves about what's, you know, going on here. And yes, some people are pursuing their passion, but other people actually are trying to also make a living, and they, you know, but a lot of us end up with side hustles and then we're ashamed of it. And I don't feel like that's really helpful or useful. So more and more now I just, like, you know, I say, of course I don't make a living as an artist. We're really not set up for that to work out. In fact, conceptually, it didn't even make sense. I wish there was a way. In Canada, it's a little bit easier because we have grants. But yeah, like, I actually like doing both, and I get a lot of energy, a lot of my creative energy and my ideas come out of my professional life now. So personally, I advocate for, like, having two things, because, you know, you're kind of, each one is feeding the other. And I often, like, make fun of what I do by day in my performances anyway. So,
yeah. Right. It gives you some experience to talk about, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely working in technology, I will say there are a lot of ridiculous things that happen.
It makes for good comedy. I love this. I do sometimes get really dreamy. And Kathleen and I have talked about this multiple times, about what it would be like to be creative for creativity's sake, not be creative for revenue's sake in some ways. And I've even talked to, for example, like, t-shirt designers who will really want to create a certain kind of t-shirt, but they know the thing that sells is the t-shirts with the owls on it or whatever it may be. And so then they're forced to, like, keep doing the owl, even right, if they don't want to. And I think some really great creative magic can come from being able to be creative without having to worry about monetization. So I do kind of envy that. at least a little bit.
Before we move forward from that conversation, I want to know a little bit about how you balance your time, because that's something that people talk about a lot whenever it comes to wanting to either pursue a passion project on the side, if they're, or a side hustle, or even like if they're working for themselves, if they want to create for creativity's sake, just really finding the time and even energy to do that. So do you have any systems or habits in place that allow you to get it all done?
I wish I had like, yeah, HubSpot's 5 tips for how to balance a million
things.
Do you
have a listicle for this that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah, here's a listicle. You like, the best one that's ever been given to me is like, you have a stove with 4 burners, which sound, you know, like nice domestic context here. And you can really only, you have to make some decisions, right? Priorities. Like you can only cook like 4 dishes, right? And you're not going to do a 12-course meal on that like 4-burner stove, not without the help of other people, for sure. So if it's just you, my advice is you're going to have to turn something off. And unfortunately, like family, this is going to sound really depressing. You have family, friends, right? Partner or love, work, right? And then maybe a side hustle. But I just named 5 things, right? So you have to turn one of them off. A lot of people turn friends off and then they find friends maybe in their work, as we know. Some people turn family off and then they end up really depressed. They're like, oh my God, I wasted my life. Why wasn't I there for them? You know, some people turn off the financial bit that I mentioned and then they end up like desperate and they have to quit, right? So it's a kind of a balancing act. You have to kind of choose the most important things for you. I would say that I've turned friends mostly off. I will, like, I'm just going to be honest rather than like tell the audience a lie. My friends are mostly the people I'm creative with, and they often are collaborators. And I actually find it wonderful. I can travel almost anywhere in the world, and there's someone I've worked with, but they're also a really good friend. And we kind of don't think about it as work anyway. So I don't know. I mean, it's a difficult thing to say, but that's what I really enjoy. So it brings me energy to be around those people.
I love this analogy a ton, because I even imagine, like, I love cooking in the kitchen and find myself pretty good at having multiple things on the stove at once. So I can even see, like, taking the analogy a little bit further, like just turning things off and on at will. So it's not like turning on your stove and letting things simmer for 8 years.
That's true.
And
you don't need to let the rice burn, right? Yeah.
Right? You can come back and switch things around as needed. And yeah. I find an analogy pretty true for myself as well. There are only so many buckets that can be filled at any moment. But you can switch them around.
I feel like mine are all boiling over right now. Not going to lie. Like everything's boiling. Like things. Okay. So in my family, me and my brother and sister, we get together every weekend and hang out with my parents. And we always end up at my sister's house playing this game on the PlayStation called Overcooked. And like things are getting set on fire. And my 3-year-old likes playing it too. And he likes just grabbing the fire extinguisher and like running around in circles. And like the little characters can cuss. And so he's just like cussing. Like putting things out anyway. But I really want to just acknowledge and say thank you for admitting that like the friends is kind of the thing that you had to turn off, and that really being in the trenches with other creatives still gives you those fulfilling relationships, because I've certainly experienced that. Even with, I don't know, I guess like I'm at this point in my life where whenever it comes to my friendships, I'd rather be creating something with you than like just standing around at a bar drinking. Like I'd rather be podcasting or working on a project. And I think that that actually really deepens your friendships and it gives them more meaning, even if it doesn't feel as like, I don't know, flippant or fun or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it brings depth and a layeredness to your relationships, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's some of the best experiences of my life outside of, you know, the experiences I've had with my partner and family have come from pursuing just like this creative passion with other people. So I definitely agree. Of course, it gets stressful sometimes, too.
Right, I know. I mean, there also are those moments where you look around and you're like, why don't I have any friends to invite to my birthday party?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that happens to me every year. No.
Like, if I wanted to host a conference, I could fill a room. But if I wanted to have a birthday party, it's like,
well, maybe it should be a birthday podcast.
Like, we can make it work, Kathleen, for sure. Life blend. Don't you fret about your birthday.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about your role then at FreshBooks as creative director. Can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory? Because it sounds like coming from, you know, an art family and family that has like roots in agency and all that, but then also your art background, like a fine arts background. How did that kind of send you into FreshBooks and like rising up to creative director there?
Yeah. Okay. So the short form story is, my parents were always super supportive, but like incredibly judgmental, right? It's like everyone's parents are always, but like, they said, you know, pursue your creative passion. I was very lucky, very privileged in that way. They weren't like, go get a practical degree. They said, you seem to love art. You should do more of that. And the design stuff, they just always like mentored me and like let me work in the family business. And so actually at a very young age, they were like, don't apply to a job as a designer. Why don't you apply as an art director? because if, you know, whatever level you come in at, it's kind of like probably the way people are going to treat you. And so I started out doing design early on, but then I got a lot of opportunities to do art direction at a very young age, like again, an embarrassingly young age. And I kind of faked it till I made it. And I remember actually the first art direction job I got was not because I was known as a designer, but because I was known as an artist for doing really experimental, weird stuff in the city. Here in Toronto, I had a collective and we did like video installations and restaurants and bars. And we were just like self-starting. And this sort of small youth marketing agency heard about it and was like, oh, we're going to do this weird thing. We want to open a gallery for Nike, which by the way, is a terrible idea. It was a disaster, but they're like, we need someone like you who can think across, you know, all of these different problems that we're going to encounter. We can think through this creatively and who has the experience kind of at that grassroots level, not to just like copy what someone else is doing, but generate new ideas. And so I was like, yeah, I'll do that. And they're like, well, what would you call yourself? And I just said I'd call myself an art director in that context. And I didn't actually, I remember actually I didn't know what that meant because I was like, I just like kind of heard
talk about
it.
This because I feel like there's like graphic designer, art director, yeah, and creative director. And what is the difference?
Yeah. And I think like in the best cases, a designer is actually probably what you should call yourself and is like capable of doing all of those things. Right. And it's really just a pay scale thing. Pretty much. Like all of these things are kind of just status and pay scale things. So they're not really important to doing a great job. They're only important if you want to get paid a little bit more, to be honest with the audience about things. So I remember calling my brother and saying like, hey, what's an art director? Like I just said, they said they wanted something like this. And I said, I think it's an art director. And what is that? Because he was doing art direction or had done some. So I called my brother and he's like, well, it's kind of like this or that. And I was like, okay, I know enough. I'm gonna just like, I'll just dive in and see what the work is. And yeah, and then I stayed with them actually only a year and I was like, this sucks. This is like way too much work. And I mean, they're asking me to do artwork as a job and I'd rather just like go do art. So I went back to grad school. And then when I finished grad school, I came out and I, again, like I said earlier, I wanted to be an artist full time, but that was really almost impossible. So I leaned on what was easy for me to do, which was to freelance as an art director. And I had that title from the past, so I had some credibility and started to do work for different agencies and the one that I used to work for too. And then actually FreshBooks was a client, of mine that came calling one day. So through a friend of a friend or something like that, they had a problem where their brand was like scattered and all over the place and they're really creative people. It's a really creative company, a really awesome company, but they like just needed someone to help focus everything. And they had some difficult challenges around that, including how their product integrated with their marketing and stuff like that. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll help out. And then this 3-month project actually turned into the career I've had here, which is a 7 or 8 year long career. And it was, yeah, really just, I just continued to take on new challenges. Once I got in here, I just found that some of the things that they were asking me to do or the opportunities that I saw were challenges that I'd never faced before because I'd always been in agencies. And I don't know if maybe your listeners have had this experience, but there's two worlds. There's this agency world where a client comes to you with work. And then there's this like what you were told is a terrible world where you're like internal on a company and like, ooh, it's going to be so boring. It's the same work every day. But in this case, it wasn't boring. In fact, it was the first time I could ever like do something, fail at it, and then like do a better thing. and then I became just addicted to that concept of like continuously improving things. That's why I say like a 3-month project turned into a 7-year project because I got to like build this thing all the way up and build a team around it and work with really inspiring people and now like work on software products and and everything. So,
So whenever you went from freelancing to going in-house full-time, like what factored into your decision-making process there? And I'm asking for maybe some of our freelancers who might be working on a contract and they're like, you know, I'm thinking about it, but maybe ego is getting in the way, or they had this dream of working for themselves. And so, you know, if they change the narrative, they're changing mm-hmm. the dream. So did any of that factor into your decision-making process? Was there any angst over it, or did it just make sense?
Yeah, I know. I said no. I said, no, I don't want to work here. Why would I give up on the dream? I was living part-time in Berlin at the time. I was like, it was fantastic. Why would I stop doing that? And what was great about the first time I said no, because I was used to saying yes, as most creatives are. It's like, I'll take whatever work you can give me. Oh, it's creative. I won't even need to get paid. You know, just. And so this was like one of the first times. I think I'd received some advice or something, but I was also just like happy with what I had accomplished. Like I was surviving. And so I said no. And that was when magical things happened, which was like the first time FreshBooks was the first company to ever say, oh, well, what would it take? Like, how could we make this work? And I was like, what? Oh, someone's asking me what I want. I've never had that. It's always been the other way. And so I said, yeah, I'd need to work like 70% time. I think I said even less than that, like 3 days a week, I think I said. And then it takes me about 5 days a week to do my artwork stuff. And I want a day off. And they compromised and we ended up at 80% time, which is what the arrangement I still have with them today. And in exchange for 80% pay, actually. But at the time for me, like having creative space was way more important than pay. And that's kind of how it went. So I really only did it because I said no. And then they were willing to like negotiate, which I think I was lucky to find. But yeah.
Right. And it doesn't sound like it was like a one-time negotiation. If you're still doing 80% time, it sounds like you started a relationship that was going to be open to growing and staying around as you grew and stay around, which sounds pretty dreamy too.
I feel like it sounds similar to our relationship with FreshBooks.
FreshBooks is great.
Like we start with ads and then we're like, but can you also buy us a yacht?
Right.
In Miami. Right.
That's on the way. We've got that almost ready to go here. We've got a team working on your yacht.
Okay. So then I think that this really ties into the culture at FreshBooks in general, being super creative and open. And it's one of the reasons why we love working with you guys. And whenever we had our Being Boss Toronto event up at FreshBooks, hearing your talk on idea thinking, I just see how it can apply to so many different creatives in companies or agencies or solopreneurs, like of all different sizes. So could we get into that a little bit? Like, tell us a little bit about idea thinking and like what those steps are.
Yeah. So I think, design thinking is kind of the
oh, sorry. I was calling it idea thinking, design thinking.
No, but I actually I don't mind idea thinking. It's a good rebrand. but I think, you know, design thinking is something, I brought with me when I came to FreshBooks. It was sort of, it's a methodology that's been around for a while, but that's really started to get popular in the mid aughts. And as I like call out this sort of what it is, as I start to talk about what it is, I'm sure your listeners are going to be like, that's what I do. And I think that that's the right attitude. So, but it's just like a reminder, if you will, of like what we all know is the right kind of way. When we feel good about a project we're working on, it's usually because we followed these basic steps that have henceforth been packaged by different companies or whomever, or authors. But really, everyone agrees to call it now design thinking, which is the design process that's existed since, I don't know, like Ray and Charles Eames had a studio in California in the 1940s, right? So basically, design thinking is like a five-step sort of process, and you can kind of come in at any step, but generally speaking, I like to start with the first step being empathy. And so that's just like going out into the world, and whether it's a customer or a client, starting with listening, right? Like, who would disagree with that? Like, start with listening, right? Don't just jump to a solution. And then from that listening, though, an observation, defining a problem, and that's the second step, kind of defining a problem statement. So like, what is it that I observed or I think I observed? Then taking that problem statement and asking yourself, like, how might we or how might I solve that problem? And then, once you have like sort of generated a lot of ideas sort of converging around one you think might represent a solution and saying, hey, this is my hypothesis. It's kind of a little bit scientific that way. Saying, I think this would work. And so building a prototype from that. And then the last step, which is kind of the most important step, is then like very quickly throwing that out into the world and testing it out. Observing again, going back to empathy, observing what the reaction was to that thing. So that, like I said, it probably sounds familiar. Like you're working on a logo. It's like, oh, I just sketched a logo. I'm going to share it with the client. And, oh, they said it sucks. Okay. I'm going to make these adjustments based on what I observed. But if you do this in a methodical way, you know, and you don't skip any steps, it can be really, really great because it's iterative. You're always building on the last cycle.
Right. I feel this is sort of a solution to two common issues that I see in creatives. And one is creating inside a box. So not ever going out and seeing what the feedback could be and just like spinning their wheels wherever they are doing the thing. And then one day sharing it and the whole world being like, well, what is that? Because they didn't bother getting feedback along the way. So one is working inside a box. And the second one is... inside of a box. I don't remember what my second one was. Snap. Hold on.
It out as fast as possible, maybe.
Yes. No, but go with that one.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I think that's the thing. As designers, and I've been this way, and I still am this way, like it doesn't feel always natural to share something that you know isn't right yet or perfect, right? Because a lot of us are perfectionists and we care about quality and detail. It's like, how could I put out this disgusting thing in it? And you convince yourself in a feedback loop inside your head, oh, this is what they're going to think, right? And so that's the biggest mistake we make, is we make assumptions about what we think people will think instead of actually just testing those assumptions with real people.
Right. And once you systemize it, it's not that much of an issue. I know so many creatives who can seriously struggle with getting feedback because they're probably only doing it at like these, you know, high points in a project or when it's like last moment necessary. But if you're systemizing that feedback and it just becomes part of your creative process, it doesn't hold that much weight over you anymore.
Yeah, it's nothing to be afraid of at that point. Also, the longer you work on things, the oh shit factor like kind of increases exponentially, right? And if you get like, what is this kind of feedback on the last day at the 11th hour? You're like, well, I can't do anything about it anyway. Oh no. Yeah, so it's always best to kind of get stuff out. Like I had a teacher once who taught me like, you know, just don't ever go beyond the sketch on that first round. Like just even a conversation is a form of design, right? Like this is what I'm thinking, right? And you can do that with your client, but you can also do that with a stakeholder or someone you're working with, a collaborator, hey, a podcast co-host. And that's the cheapest thing you can do to validate, hey, I think this might work, or this, you know, just to get the data that you need to make a better product ultimately without spinning neurotically out of control.
For sure. We know creatives tend to do that. So systemizing, not doing that is super important.
I wanted to talk about systemizing a little bit and the structure around design thinking, because I think a lot of us, as you were mentioning, Jeremy, use design thinking intuitively in our creative process. Like it's kind of just the natural backbone of how people make things happen, right? But do you really, like let's say you're setting up your tasks in Asana or whatever project management software you have, like are you laying out those five steps and saying, okay, for this phase, I need to go do a survey or call up some of our customers or do this. And then in this next step, here are some action steps associated with that. Like, have you actually literally systemized this and worked within that structure, or is it still kind of more intuitive?
I mean, at FreshBooks, we have like a pretty defined way of doing it. But I would say in my personal practice, it's become so innate that I really don't have very many other ways of working. I will say sometimes though, and I've leaned into like doing other steps first. So like instead of like sometimes I don't need to empathize with my own creative process because I kind of know the space that I'm in. And so I might start with a prototype. Like I might skip a bunch of steps and throw that out into the world and get feedback as quickly as possible and then make that observation and then use that to cycle again. So I might skip steps here or there, but generally, just so I can get back to the start again kind of thing. But generally speaking, it's just like programmed now for me. I can't really think any other way. But then also as an artist, I was trained to do this. So like it was like, you know, of course you do a sketch before you do a masterpiece or whatever, right? That's what you're taught to do.
Exactly. So can we go back through the steps and maybe talk about different pitfalls or mistakes or challenges that you might encounter in each step and how to maybe overcome those?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like the first step is where most people make a ton of mistakes in empathizing, which is hard to do. And some would say impossible to do really, right? To really understand another human being, right? You can't get inside of their skin or inside of their head unless you're like a psychopath or something like that. And even then it just wouldn't work out. So, and what, you know, the pitfall there is you're bringing a lot of your own unconscious bias to your observation of the world, right? So whatever you think is true, even as you're observing it and doing your best to listen, you're also bringing all of your experiences to that observation. And so a lot of people get tripped up by their unconscious bias, what they think they see, you know, and believing that that's true. And there are tricks to get around that, which I could do a whole podcast on, but the best trick is just like, to open your ears, to listen and observe without judgment. I often like coach people on like, you know, reserving judgment because it's a different way of thinking, right? Like if you're judging, it means you're processing what you're seeing rather than actually seeing it. If you're drawing, I'm sure anyone who's taking a drawing lesson, they know that they have to turn off a certain part of their brain to actually see what they're drawing, right? Like to see light and dark instead of outline. You need to like learn to draw on it. You need to learn to see. There's a lot of books on that topic. So a lot of people forget that.
I'm remembering my like art school days of like drawing upside down.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like,
yeah.
Like really seeing it.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I often, there's a bunch of things you can do. You can like do like we did at the beginning of this podcast where we recorded. You can do all kinds of things. Like you can like just like stop doing anything. Don't think don't speak. Just nothing. Just pure meditation for 30 seconds. Try that. Then observe, right? Or like you said, change the context. Move around. You know, figure out how you could see something from another perspective. There are lots of little things you can do. But ultimately, it all comes down to first recognizing that you're probably bringing bias to whatever you're observing. And certainly for me as like a straight white male, like I have to recognize that if I'm serving someone else, that I'm probably bringing a ton of cultural, sociological baggage to whatever I'm observing. And so I really need to reserve judgment.
Only there were more straight white males like you, Jeremy.
Well, yeah. Maybe if in general there's just less straight white males.
But I think, right.
That is a solution I had not considered yet.
Yeah. It's part of the reason why we're one and done. Because the world doesn't need more.
Well, I would say like, and if only more of them asked more W questions, like instead of mansplaining or whatever, right? So if only more of them reserved judgment. So that's the first step. And I think the biggest pitfall people make is that they judge too soon and they fail to actually observe.
I just want to mention too, like this idea of there's something that you said about processing, and like as you're processing something, you are judging it. And it really is making me think about this in a different way. And anytime I'm trying to process, like I'm trying to just come to a solution as fast as possible, probably because I'm afraid. Like as a designer or an artist or a podcaster or a writer or anything, I'm just afraid that I'm never going to get to that solution. So I start immediately processing and trying to put that
right
at the beginning of the process.
Right. Like we've all been in those ridiculous meetings and there's a short deadline. Oh my God, it's going to Friday. They want something by Friday. What could we do? Right. You jump straight to the solution. We could do this. We could do that. I was like, well, why would we do any of those things? No one stops to ask. And if you start with that why, you know, then you're flipping the game, right? And you're moving into empathy. So I think it's very, very important if you ever catch yourself in that position. But even as you're trying to observe, you're going to try and jump to, oh, we could do this to solve that problem. But it's way too soon to be thinking that way. And yeah, if you just spent 90% of your time on the empathy part, actually, you would probably have a much better idea anyway. Just like get out of the way of yourself, basically. So should I keep going through these or like,
yeah,
there's like,
I mean, wait, okay. So we've gone through empathy and then
what
was the next one?
Yeah. One of five steps.
Okay. Yeah. Let's keep going.
Okay. So in the next step, which would be like defining a problem or definition, I think the key thing here is that, what you want to observe is like, it depends on the context, but generally, like, there are two kinds of things you're looking for, you know, from your observations. Things that surprised you, which would be what I would call insights, right? Like, the things that you just didn't expect, right? And if you did your job right, there'd be a lot of those things because you've reserved judgment. You're like, whoa, I didn't realize that women had feelings or something like
that. Or whatever it may be.
Whatever it may be, right? I didn't realize things suck for them when I act this way. So that would be like one of the things you might be looking for. The other thing would be like a need, which is a verb, like something someone's trying to do or achieve. And in most contexts, there's like some kind of a need, right? In marketing world, they might call that an ask or something like that. But you'd want to observe that ask or get more information on what it actually is and why it matters to them. So those would be the kind of the two things that are most important when defining a problem that you're going to be solving, is like, you know, is basically the insight, like the surprising thing that you just didn't expect, and the ask or the why are we, you know, what is it they're trying to achieve and why are they trying to achieve that? And so you have to really have done a good job on the previous step to make this actually work. And coming out of that, hopefully you have some kind of a problem statement, which would be something like, I have observed this and it's causing this negative outcome or this impact or whatever. And so then you can ask yourself, and this is kind of an important word hack that a lot of people recommend. I think it came out of Google or IDEO. I can't remember, which is if you phrase it kind of as a, how might we, which is like, what you want to do at this stage is like open the language to the, you know, the most number of possibilities, right? And using language that doesn't say like, doesn't constrain your opportunity to solve a problem in as many ways as possible is super important. A lot of people create these super narrow problem statements when they're working on stuff. And even clients' briefs can sometimes be that, like, make an ad starring chickens for, you know, KFC or something like that. And you're like, well, do we, like, why? Why do you want chickens, this thing? You're already defining the solution. So a lot of people trip up by putting a solution in their problem, and that's not really a problem, I guess. That would be the big trip up there.
Okay, I have a question. Like, bringing this back to the scientific experiment side of things, is it possible to have too many variables? Like, should you, even though you don't want to have that specific or like that solution in the problem statement, do you want to try and narrow in on like one variable to solve at a time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think like I would always recommend there being, you could like writing more than one problem statement if you're in the habit of doing that. And saying,
like, whenever you were redesigning FreshBooks, which is like a huge project, because it wasn't just a branding project. It was like literally changing the entire interface and user experience. Did you have a lot of different problem statements? Different teams working on those?
Yes. Like, absolutely. We've probably written about 1,000 statements that comprise all of the problems we were trying to solve, and every day there are new ones. And so, but I will say that you want to start at the macro level and work your way down in granularity. That's where it is important eventually to get to specifics. But when you're like trying to solve a problem, like I need to redesign a whole product and a brand and a whole, you know, and a strategy for the future, you kind of want to start with those broad strokes first. As you know, in creating anything long-term, you know, start with the big broad strokes and strategy, and hopefully those boil down to some principles that can then inform, you know, more and more granular problems. So I think it's more like there's a pyramid of decisions that you need to make.
I'm also like thinking about our own creative process. Like for me and Emily, we probably get down into the granular and then expand back out to broad strokes. Like I would even imagine that we start on a more granular area, like because that's where we can see the problem. Mm. And then going back out to broad strokes, like, okay, let's widen this out a little bit and then narrowing back in.
Do you guys ever do, sorry, not you guys, I shouldn't use that language. That's you okay. All ever use, like, do you ever do five whys? Have you ever heard that concept, which is to ask why 5 times? Like,
yes.
Okay. Yeah. So that would be, you could do that, right? You could start at the very specific. You'd say like, something very, very specific about whatever problem you're solving, and then just ask, why is that? And then, you know, between two of you, you might generate an answer. And then if, you know, the next person asks why, if you do that 5 times, theoretically, you should get to something that's quite systemic, But it could also lead to something very specific, and that's not a bad thing.
I know this is probably like going off on a tangent a little bit, but I feel like the main barriers for creative entrepreneurs and getting more customers always comes down to time and money. Like those seem to always be the barriers that people throw out. And I think that asking five whys, like why do people need more time? And then asking the why of that answer and really getting down to the whys behind time and money are really what get you to the root of how to sell to your customer or like what their real problem is.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a very, that's a very cheap and easy trick, which is write why five times on a piece of paper and then just, you know, remember. And it's hard, but it's hard to do, right? Because especially if you're talking to someone else, like a stakeholder, when you ask why, and you can use other language as long as it's in the spirit of why, sometimes people get defensive about like, what do you mean, why do I care about this?
It's super challenging. Even whenever we do it to ourselves, it's super challenging. And I want to give up by the second why. Like, oh, just because.
Just because, yeah.
It's like I'm speaking to my inner toddler. Because so I usually said would just say,
my easy trick to avoid that is just say, tell me more about that. And that's a lot less, like, sort of confrontational. Yeah. Or why do you think that is? Like, as long as it's just not like, why?
Design thinking therapy.
Yeah.
Okay, what next?
Okay, so next, you want to, like, you have this problem worth solving. Hopefully, you're excited about it. The next thing you would want to do is come up with some ideas, some solutions. And the biggest pitfall here would be to, like, focus in on one solution too early, what they call in design, like, you know, converging too early. So you might have like five ideas and immediately like, nah, we'll just do this one because the rest, it's not, yeah, this is the one I like. You know, you might choose a favorite too early. Or you might not even generate any other ideas. You just like, no, it's got to be this. And the problem with doing that is you're like potentially missing out on all kinds of like just delightful, crazy ideas. And my biggest trick for this is like a very common one. I'm sure people have heard of this, which is called crazy eights. And just take a piece of paper, fold it into eight, and then set a timer for under 10 minutes, like 5 minutes even, and very quickly sketch out eight ideas to any problem. Like, and I don't know why it's eight, don't ask me, but it's really hard to do. But it gets easier the more you do it. And you just want to like, you don't want to write. That's the other thing. It's like generally when generating ideas, language for some reason prevents us from thinking divergently, from thinking about the most number of possibilities. And so typically you should draw. I don't know if that's recommended very often outside of design. Like I don't know how many business people are drawing, but when I'm coaching business people on how to think and ideate, you know, I teach them to draw because it uses a different part of the brain. And also you don't get caught in the details like the grammar or the words. And we've all been there when someone's like, I don't think that's quite the right word you're using or whatever. But a triangle, no one can judge that. Anyway, so and you don't have to be good at drawing. You just have to be able to like convey an abstract idea, right, without language very quickly. So that's kind of like the main thing to do in ideation. And then when you get a large volume of ideas, it's much easier to see, you know, there's crossover potentially where one idea is half good and you could take from the other. And then when one of your ideas you might be really excited about and you want to refine it, you might later realize, oh no, shit, this won't work. But you have those like seven other ideas from earlier. You're like, oh, but this, that's another jumping off point. We could go that way instead of being just stuck, you know? And so if you do that with a team of people, it's even more exciting because you're potentially generating like 40 ideas in 5 minutes. And if you could do that like open, close, like 40 ideas, then back down to one idea, then 40 ideas. If you do that over and over again in a period of like, if you do it in a cycle of three, like do it three times. I challenge the listeners to do this in a span of a half an hour. You'll be amazed at what you're able to achieve in 30 minutes that would have otherwise taken a week of just following one stubborn idea through.
This has me craving the like most intense brainstorm session. Kathleen, bring your papers.
I know, right? I just want to brainstorm now because I will say that we probably very quickly go to just creating the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we might kind of go through this process just very fast, like in our minds, but it's
you might
not
be doing it in your
articulated.
Head. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that there is, though, something that is really important to actually going through the process and articulating each step of the process. So if this is your first time to go through a creative process or to really give your creative process more boundaries and structure and definition, to actually do these exercises might astound you. Like, it's not enough. I talk about this all the time with the chalkboard method, but it's not enough to understand the concept. Like, actually going through it will do wonders for your creative process, right?
Yeah, and we do tend to self-edit and say, well, I don't need it because I'm a pro or whatever. I will say the other thing that's really important to ideation is like, and so you said brainstorming, and like immediately I was like, oh no, that's a bad word. And but like, it's just not the current, like the douchebag word now is ideation or whatever. Like, it's the industry word.
Gotcha. Like, thank you for schooling me on that.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Wait, so why is brainstorming a bad word?
I think because it, like, well, so here's what happened is, like, it got out that brainstorming was producing worse ideas. Like, there are a bunch of studies where groups of people get together. And I forgot to say, like, apparently that, you know, you get this HIPPO problem, the highest paid person in the room. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
Where it's just,
yeah,
ends up being not like really a brainstorm, or it's like a brain jerk, like someone owns the room and shames everyone else. There are no bad ideas, but really there's like the loudest idea that wins. And so like the pitfall there is like that you don't actually end up with those 40 ideas. And the way around that is like, is to do like it alone. And this is maybe great for your listeners, which is like, you might think you need a group of people to do ideation or brainstorming with, but actually, like at a company like ours and at the biggest companies in the world now, people do like, they sit quietly for 5 minutes and they just come up with ideas and then they share them. And they generate far more ideas in isolation, like solo, just at the idea phase. Actually, the one time where you can just be, it's just you, and it's wonderful. It's great. Like, it's where you wanted to be the whole time anyway, right?
So, right. That's what I want to do. Not brainstorming, but ideating.
Yeah, I want to come up with ideas all day. Yeah.
At my branding agency, whenever we're taking people through our creative process, if it's with an organization, sometimes what we do is there's a bunch of white papers hanging up and a bunch of different ideas, and people are kind of voting with stickers.
Oh, yeah.
And if the CEO goes first, people are just following behind him and like, or her, and just sticking their dot on whatever idea they put their dot on. And so we've started like mixing up colors so that nobody knows, and we have to start in different areas. But this is even making me think about how we go through that process and how we could better facilitate better ideas coming out of that process.
And what you're solving with the dot voting problem, of course, is the same problem I just described, which is like, when it comes time to sharing ideas, who's going to choose the right idea? Oh, like the loudest voice again, there they are, right?
Right.
And they might not be thoughtfully considering everyone's point of view. And sometimes, like, at that phase, the best ideas are kind of the ones everyone thinks are stupid. Like, they're these really fragile ideas. And I'm sure maybe you haven't heard of this, but I like to use this, like, a grammar hack, which is to make sure everyone's kind of saying yes and when they see an idea, right? Like, building on it rather than just saying like what's wrong with it or outlining what's wrong with it, but sort of like, you know, this, everything's super fragile at that stage, but that doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It just means it needs help. It needs nurturing. It needs some support. But loud people don't always see that.
Awesome. So have we gone through all 5 of our steps?
No.
No? We did 3,
we
correct?
Can like combine the 2 last steps into 1 just to, for the sake of time. And our listeners are probably almost at work and they need to get out of the car. prototype and test are the next 2 steps. But basically, like, coming up with something that represents what you think the final object might be realistically in some kind of scenario, and then putting in front of the end user or end customer. So, you know, I would encourage people in a client scenario, don't always think of your client as the end customer. If you could get to the real customer, like the person they're serving, that would be ideal. Now, of course, they've had a lot of experiences, but like I said earlier, they're also bringing a lot of their bias to a conversation. So whenever possible, we try, at least at FreshBooks and in my life outside of FreshBooks, to get it in front of the final customer, the final consumer, whomever. Before I do that, making sure that I have a hypothesis, which is just in, like, without getting into science language, like what I think will be true, and which in my experience is 90% of the time absolutely wrong.
Then you're you're doing it right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you measure what's true? Like, so for you in performance art, is it getting laughs? Is it getting attendance? Or, you know, what is that like?
Yeah, I think for me, yeah. So you can, it can be any, it doesn't have to be like, it should be measurable, but it doesn't have to be like from a data MySQL dashboard or something like that. It can be, like you said, it could be like, I expect that I'm going to get a laugh on this joke, right? Or it could be, I expect this person will say this. They'll notice this. Given my objective, right, was to like convince them to buy this thing, I expect they will click this button. Or they will, when I ask them what this advertisement was about, they'll be able to tell me what it's about, right? Like, just make it so that you can test. Like, a test has to have an answer, and you have to be able to observe the answer, basically. That's all.
For sure. I love this. And is this a process that you super cognizantly go through with your team consistently when you guys are facing problems?
Yeah. So we have like, we have a version of this process that, we've modified for our teams, in which they basically interact in every week with customers, where they're like observing, defining the problem, coming up with ideas, prototyping and testing with them on a weekly cycle. We do it once a week at least. And we just repeat that. So I guess it's, you know, 50 or so times a year.
I was about to say, it feels like you guys have really, with this process, embraced a culture of, I don't know, not getting it right the first time. Like, it seems like you guys are really open to, I don't want to say failing, but like failing, for lack of a better word, because it's really just about iterating and making it better every single time. And you can't make it better without knowing what went wrong. But yeah. I think so many of us are afraid to confront like what went wrong, right?
Yeah, I will say that, like, yeah, I'll be very honest. I think even though we have this process, I notice all the time us slipping back. And it's like very, you want it. It's like so relaxing. That's like such a nice velvety like lounge chair to sit back into, you know, just get into the solution. Like, oh, it feels so good to get into that warm bath where others aren't judging me, and, you know, where I don't have to put myself and my reputation on the line week over week. And so I would say it's like, you know, you're constantly diligent about it. And that's kind of my job as well here, right? Is to make sure that teams are in an environment where it feels a little like a warm bath, hopefully, instead of like a cold shower every time they go through this process. Because it can feel a little uncomfortable, I'll just be honest.
It's like super vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so making sure it's right. That's right. Making sure that you're bringing your whole self to, and exposing yourself to this vulnerability, it can be really, really challenging. And our team slip back into bad habits all the time. I do as well. And there's no judgment there. But it's just like, you know, you remind yourself that, oh, yeah, that's why we do it this way. You know, every time you mess it up, you kind of figure it out again. And so we're always doing it.
I could definitely see it being super vulnerable within a team. But as like a solo entrepreneur, someone who's really just doing it for yourself, I see it being the most skill building, like brain exercise almost, to like really look at all of your problems from as many facets as possible after gathering all the information you need to really go at it. Like that's something that will teach you about your people and what you do and how you serve them in ways that, you know, nothing else really will. If you're really putting yourself through that cycle every single time you're faced with a problem or looking for a new solution to a problem, you're just going to be super boss.
I know. I feel like a lot of the creatives we talk to crave more space to make things with their hands. And I feel like this is like a very hands-on process. Like this is giving you structure to create the space to be incredibly creative, but without feeling like you're floundering or without feeling like, I might as well just go watch YouTube for 3 hours. Or I think it really gives it this, it gives the creative process boundaries that you can really flourish within.
Yeah, and hopefully some like objective distance is good, because we're such like subjective beings every once in a while. I will say, like, as a like almost like a segue, I use this not just for design or creative projects, but I kind of optimize everything this way now. So and I have a hard time not doing that. So my partner and wife often says, you know, that I shouldn't bring my work life into our relationship, but I often Honestly, it's made
you break out the 8 pieces of paper for date night.
Yeah, exactly. But I can't help, like, certainly bringing those empathy qualities to a relationship or to a problem that you're facing personally can also be super useful. And then, like, trying things out and then not being okay with admitting to someone that you were wrong, which I think is a super powerful concept socially, right? For us to try things out and then admit we were wrong and have the objective kind of relationship with our work to say, like, oh my God, I messed up. And I didn't, I'm going to go back to empathizing and listening again. I don't know. Yeah.
Good practice all around for sure. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for coming to hang out with us.
Oh, no. Thank you so much for having me and for your listeners for listening. If they're still there, I don't know. Maybe we
bored them. They are. They're
still
there.
They totally are. Eating it up, I'm sure. All right. I have a question for you.
Okay.
What makes you feel most boss?
I thought about this because you sent me the questions in advance. And I actually had a hard time with this because I have like a kind of a lame answer. The thing that makes me feel most boss is not being the boss, I guess, which would be listening, especially like because I am a boss. I had to like reflect I'm a boss to a lot of people here. But the times I feel most boss is when I'm walking, like I go on walks with everyone here and I'm listening to people and I'm getting to know them and I'm building rapport and they're trusting me with their feelings, their thoughts, and I'm being surprised by things that I just didn't know were either problems or, you know, opportunities. And so I feel like when I do that, I'm in just this amazing place to coach people. Based on the experience and the privilege I've had in my life. And so I feel most boss when I listen to people and then I give them some solid advice.
I love it. Good answer.
I know. I feel like that's one of my favorite answers yet.
I agree. That was a good one. Good job. That was a good one.
Thank you.
All right. And where can our listeners learn more about you and your projects and what you're working on?
I think like, oh yeah, maybe just Twitter. I know it's not... It's not in style these days, but they just doubled the character limit so we could have a better conversation.
Wait, when did that happen?
Like last week, I think.
Yeah. You have to kind of hack it, I think, to get it. But anyway, at Jeremy Bailey on Twitter is my handle.
Perfect.
Cool. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for hanging out with us. It's been really cool getting to reconnect with you.
Oh, no, I loved it. I hope I can one day have you on my podcast.
We would love to come on your podcast anytime.
We're down.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Kathleen. Really appreciate this.
We have gotten so much amazing feedback over the years from listeners about how our podcast has helped them start to grow and uplevel their businesses. So we want to celebrate you. Here's the boss we're celebrating this week.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Bursky, and I am Being Boss. I'm a certified life and career coach working with ambitious women in their 20s at compassmaven.com. And this week, I'm celebrating getting my first official paycheck from a speaking gig. I've been doing a bunch of unpaid speaking, but this is my first physical check in the mail for getting up and talking in front of people, and it feels so, so good.
If you're feeling boss and want to submit your own boss moment or win, go to www.beingboss.club/IamBeingBoss. This episode of Being Boss was brought to you by FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. Thank you to FreshBooks for sponsoring us, and you guys can try it for free by going to freshbooks.com/beingboss. Thank you so much to our team and sponsors who make Being Boss possible. Our sound engineer and web developer, Corey Winter. Our editorial director and content manager, Caitlin Brame. Our community manager and social media director, Sharon Lukey. And our bean counter, David Austin, with support from Braid Creative and Indie Shopography. Do the work, be boss, and we'll see you next week.